Hi, this is Bernie Wise on the air today for the new year. Wish everybody a happy new year. And we're broadcasting this morning live. So if you have any questions about anything we say and want to call in to the station, I'll give you the phone number before we start, 718-497-2128. That's if you want to call in and say hello and just if you have a question. And the other thing is, that, if you need any information about the radio station or the operation, info@heritageradio.com. And our sponsor this morning is TechServe, and this is going to be live on the air, so that's why I said you can call into the show. So today we're going to talk about evolution and Darwin, because it happens to be, well, we just missed the year, but that's okay. 200 years since his birth. And 150 years since he published his first, his famous book, Origin of the Species. And my guest this morning is Saul Scheinbach. Did I say it right, Saul?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Good. Okay, and Saul is, he'll tell you about his background, and then we'll get into the topic. So, Saul, why don't you tell people how you got interested in all this stuff?
Well, I'm a homegrown boy. My degree is in molecular genetics from the City University of New York. And I worked in industry. That was where my career was, mostly for a food company. But I also taught courses around local colleges. And as a biologist, I certainly had to learn about evolution, and it's been of interest to me for decades. Currently, I'm the vice president and science advisor for the Hudson River Audubon Society of Westchester. And I write a column there called Science Watch. And many of those columns are about aspects of evolution. And that's on a website. It's at www.hras.org.
Good. So people can, instead of reading your column, they can hear it live.
Today they can hear it live, yes.
Okay. So we're here to talk about evolution first. And so why is this a really important topic to talk about?
Well, it's gotten a lot of publicity this past year. As you said, 2009 was a very important year because of those anniversaries you mentioned. Darwin was born on the same day as Abraham Lincoln, February 12, 1809. And his book came out in November of that year. So it's just a couple of months ago, 150 years passed. It was a hot seller when it came out. It sold out the first day. And so, as I said, evolution has gotten a lot of publicity. And it's certainly worthwhile talking about because many people have trouble with evolution. They don't believe it's really true.
Yes, and they even say it's still a theory. But, it's hard for people to believe it, that evolution really works.
Well, so, in fact, yeah. I have the results of a poll here.
Yes.
And this was done over a number of years. In 34 countries, people were interviewed. And the question was, is evolution true or false? And guess where the United States falls out on that poll of 34 countries?
Hmm.
It falls out way down at the bottom, number 33, one above Turkey. In America, only 40% of the population thinks that evolution is true. 40% think it's false, and 20% are not sure.
Hmm.
And that's opposed to, say, the Scandinavian countries or the Western European countries, where upwards of 70 or 80% of the citizens believe that evolution is true.
So today, I think we're going to... stress to the folks listening in that it's not really a theory anymore, that it's really an essential part of biology.
Right? Well, I have a great quote here from, of all places, the New York Times. And it says, in science, a theory is not a hunch, but an explanation backed by abundant observation and where gaps in knowledge are not seen as grounds for doubt, but points for future understanding. And that's what science is all about.
Right. You start something at the beginning and you build on it. So really the thing that we're all building on is Darwin's theory in present-day evolutionary science and the new Evo-Devo branch of it, which we'll talk about later, I hope. Okay, so let's really get down to specifics now. And we're going to start with some terms that we should use, you know, as ground rules. So what is it? What is a species salt? Let's start off with that.
An easy definition of a species is a freely interbreeding population that produces viable, fertile young. In other words, if you and I can get together and make babies, and those babies can make babies, then we are in the same species.
So, is this a proposal?
Of course. Okay. If you and I could get together, we'd make a lot of money.
We do well, because you're tall and I'm small.
Right.
It would be great.
Right. Now, what is not a species? Commonly, people know about a mule. A mule is not a species. A mule is a cross between a horse and a donkey. And mules can't make more mules. The reason they can't do that is because their chromosome number is a little screwed up, and the chromosomes can't match up when they're supposed to. And the mule can't make mature sex cells. It can't make eggs or sperm. It can't make eggs or sperm. You're sterile.
Okay, so that's basically a species. Yeah, a species can reproduce with only members of the same species.
Correct.
Successfully.
Correct.
Okay. Now, what about new species forming? Because that's what Darwin did a lot of research on and stuff.
So, well, I think we should, before we talk about new species forming, we should let the audience know what Darwin actually said.
Okay, go ahead.
And what he said after 20 years of cogitating on it was very simply that species form through a process that he called natural selection of inherited characteristics. What Darwin said was there is a struggle in nature. He didn't call it survival of the fittest. We often hear about that. He called it the struggle for existence. And what he said was, resources are finite, but organisms keep multiplying, and they multiply very rapidly. And eventually they come up against this barrier where there are not enough resources. So when things are good, when things are going well and life is easy, it's kind of like a kindergarten class where there's some kind of a contest, and the teacher ends up giving out prizes to everybody. Everybody gets something. You don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But oftentimes, life really is a struggle, and I would liken it to the Olympics. In the Olympics, one guy wins the race. One guy wins, and he usually wins by just a split second. So if one individual or some individuals have a particular adaptation that gives them that tiny bit of edge, then they are going to succeed over the other individuals. And what does that mean? That means they're going to pass that trait. If it's inherited, they're going to pass that trait on to their children.
Okay, so Saul, I think that's perfect for talking about species and new species and things. And you mentioned the word adaptation. So can you just give us an example of that?
Right. Oh, an adaptation? Well, let's talk about humans for a moment.
Okay.
We like talking about ourselves all the time. People consider lactose intolerance an illness, but 10,000 years ago, we were all lactose intolerant. Think about it. It didn't make sense for us to be able to digest milk as an adult because the only milk we got was mother's milk. And lactose is the main sugar in milk. And if we didn't get it anymore, well, why would we need to have the machinery, the enzymes to digest it? So early on in an infant's life, we all lost the ability to make lactose, to digest lactose, rather. However, about 6,000-7,000 years ago, people in what's now modern-day Sweden began dairy farming. And all of a sudden, it made a difference. If you could retain the ability to digest lactose in your adulthood, you could survive the winter better than the guy who couldn't. And that tiny bit of difference allowed you to make more children, and the ability to digest lactose became prominent. And even today, we see that that ability is retained in people from Northern Europe and not other groups.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an example of an adaptation that's inherited.
Right. That's a terrific example, because there are still many people who are still lactose intolerant, right? So if it came down to milk and not or no milk. If there was milk available, like you said, the Swedes pioneered this milk. And the winter was a terrible time in the old days because after the harvest, you had to ration everything out to last the whole winter. So it was important to get the milk. So what we're going to do now is we're going to stop for a second and take a break. And I want to remind you, we're broadcasting today from Roberta's restaurant in the beautiful downtown Bushwick. It's a beautiful sunny day today, 20 degrees, but the sun is shining. And we'll be back in a minute. And remember, we're live today. So if you'd like to talk to us, you can call in. Here we are back again on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Bernie Wides, the naturalist, and my guest today is Saul, who has written a lot on evolution and Darwin. And we're going to come back, and Saul's going to have a little quote directly from Darwin's, one of his writings, about evolution and...
natural selection.
And natural selection. Okay, so Saul, take over.
So here's what Darwin wrote in his book, The Origin of Species. I think it's a great quote. It may be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing the world. Every variation, even the slightest, rejecting that which is bad, preserving and adding up all that is good, silently and insensibly working whenever and wherever opportunity offers at the improvement of each being. Now people still have a lot of trouble with this. And as you said before, Bernie, they talk about it and call it a theory. And I want to point out that people don't have trouble, say, with Newton's theory. Newton's theory says that when you throw a ball up in the air, it's going to come down, and it always comes down, and we accept that. That doesn't seem to disturb us. But what Darwin said is, when we look at life around us, we see evolution occurring. All the diversity of life, he said, is descended from a common ancestor through this process of natural selection. Everything we look at in biology points to that, by the way, even today. Mm-hmm. And I would say one other point. Newton's ideas on gravity don't hold at the subatomic level. That's why physicists had to invent quantum mechanics. Yet after 150 years of scientific scrutiny, everything that we know in biology today backs up what Darwin has said 150 years ago. There is nothing in biology that could work without understanding evolution. Otherwise, biology is simply a set of descriptions. Natural selection, evolution through natural selection, unites everything that we learn in biology. There's a famous geneticist who said nothing in biology makes sense except in the light of evolution.
Right. So you know what it is, Saul? I think that it's, you know, something like gravity is easy because you can see it right away. But evolution and this idea that man is descended from our common ancestor, which was probably a fish, and I think it sounds a little too fishy for people, and they have trouble with thinking of their ancestors as apes and all that. So, you know, you see all those cartoons making fun of it. But as you said, all of biology really rests on the shoulders of Darwin.
That's right.
And it's such an important idea that we have to go from that it really works. And we'll give some more examples of evolution working. But so as you said, Darwin's theory fits into biology today, because today we're working on stuff that Darwin didn't even know, but based on his stuff.
Yeah, well, people, it's interesting you talk about people thinking we evolved from apes or monkeys or whatever they say. I even heard that recently at the Museum of Natural History, where I know you're a docent, you're involved there. And there's an exhibit on extreme mammals showing all different families of mammals and their sizes. And a couple was there, and the woman turned to the man. And now you would think these are people who are interested in natural history because they're at the museum. And she turned to her companion, and she said, "I still don't believe we came from monkeys."
Yep, that's the thing. And then, you know, there's all about religion and all that, but we won't talk about that now. Maybe on the second part of the show, we can get into all that.
Well, let's talk about how new species form, how Darwin said new species form.
Yeah, let's just do this first. Darwin didn't know anything about genes.
Correct. Right?
He didn't know the mechanism.
Correct.
For species and all that. So we'll talk about genes in a minute, but first you want to talk about Darwin and...
Yeah. What did he say about species formation? I mean,
right.
We don't think about it today, but before he wrote this book, people thought that species were immutable.
Right.
They were made perfectly by God, and they didn't change. And Darwin was an iconoclast. He broke that rule, and he said, "Yes, they do change." And he said they can change by having a group separate from the rest. Usually by some physical means. Mm-hmm. So if a mountain range forms and splits up a group, or a new lake forms and one group is on one side from the other, they can go through certain adaptations. We just talked a few minutes ago about adaptations. And if one group changes in some way so that they can't breed anymore with the founding group, now we have a new species, because we have what's called reproductive isolation. Mm-hmm. And that change can be a physical change in the genitals, for example. The genitals don't match anymore. But oftentimes it's a change in behavior. Birds are prime examples of extreme courtship behavior. We've seen birds do that. And so, for example, if you're jumping up and down in front of me when you're supposed to be bowing and cooing, well, that's not going to turn me on. I like something different, and I'm not going to want to mate with you.
Mm-hmm.
So behavioral changes occur. It could be timing. I could start breeding sooner than you, since I've been separated from you. So if these changes occur, and now the two groups meet again, if they're not freely interbreeding, or that's what we said a species does, they're no longer freely interbreeding, they're two separate species. And Darwin said it. He said all that.
Right. He studied all that and said it. I mean, that's the basis for what we're talking about, is Darwin's research over those years. And he was a terrific observer. And that's why we say we stand on the shoulders of Darwin for modern-day biology. Right, and another scientist, of course, but that's it basically. So we spoke about a species, and we said a species is you have to be able to breed, and if you can't reproduce, then you're not in that species anymore. So what about are new species forming all the time, Saul?
You know, watching evolution could be like watching the grass grow. But in fact, there are many examples now where scientists have observed the formation of new species. One example is this little fish called the stickleback, the three-spined stickleback that lives in the coastal oceans. And after the last ice age, as the glaciers melted around 12,000 years ago, they formed all these inland lakes. And these little fish swam up into these lakes, and they got isolated. And when they were living in the open ocean, they had this body armor consisting of spines sticking out from their backs, back and their bellies.
Therefore, they were called sticklebacks.
That's why they got their name, right. Exactly. And that helped them kept them from being eaten. You know, big fish eat little fish, but when you're a big fish and you suck in this little guy and he opens those spines, you spit him out. So the sticklebacks entered these lakes, these freshwater lakes. But now their major enemy, believe it or not, is the dragonfly larva that lives in the bottom of these lakes, and it's a sneak predator.
So that's a good example of species changing. Well, should we call it speciation?
They lost their spines.
They lost their spines, poor little fish, and. Sounds like one of those nursery rhymes. They lost their spines and they can't find them. But we're going to. Talk more about this topic, and the next topic we're going to get into is about genes, because everybody knows about genes today, and designer genes, and regular genes, and genes that are made by Levi, and genes that are made by Gap, but we're going to talk about different kind of genes. So we're going to stop for a minute and take a break, but we're going to take a little drink of water. And we'll be back in a minute. And remember, Heritage Radio Network, The Naturalist. And as I said, if you want to call in, I'll give you that number again, 718-497-2128. And don't go away. We'll be back with some more interesting talk from Saul. Hi, this is Bernie Weinsbach, The Naturalist, with our show today dealing with evolution and Darwin. It's a terrific topic, and you know you could talk a month on this topic, but we don't have a month. In fact, we only have one more segment right now, and we're going to come back to the topic, and I'm going to put Saul back on because he's my expert today. And are we going to talk about genes now, Saul?
Yes.
Okay. So, you hear a lot about genes, and I just kid around and talk about designer genes, but they really are designer genes that we have and all the critters that are alive on the Earth, because they are designed to do certain specific things. But there are a lot of questions about them, how they get turned on and all that stuff. And Saul, tell us something about genes.
Well, a gene is nothing more than a stretch of DNA, and DNA is this genetic material. It can copy itself, make exact copies of itself, and every organism has DNA. So a gene is composed of the DNA letters. There are four letters that make up DNA, four different subunits. We'll call them A, T, C, and G. And a gene could be 1,000 or more letters. And what do genes do? Well, we can divide them into two major groups. There are genes that make structure. So there are genes that make our body structure, the proteins that make up our body, the skin proteins and the proteins in bone hemoglobin for blood, all of those are proteins, and they are made by genes. Now, there's another set of genes that bosses those genes around. It controls them, and it tells them when to turn on and when to turn off. And it does that through switches.
Mm. So where are these genes, Saul?
Well, in what we call eukaryote organisms, they're in the nucleus.
Of the cell.
They're in the cell, in the nucleus of the cell.
Mm-hmm.
One example that I could provide about controlling the genes is when we go out into the sun, most of us, get tan. We get tan in one way or another. We make a pigment called melanin. How does that happen? Well, the sun damages our skin cells, and in response, the gene that makes this pigment gets turned on and makes more of this pigment called melanin. So that's a way we control genes to make this pigment.
Yeah. So the genes are responding to the environment.
Correct.
And producing this to protect us.
Correct.
Okay. So the genes are in every cell in our body. Is that right, Saul?
Yes. And this.
And we're just talking about eukaryotes, which means critters that have a nucleus. Critters that don't have a nucleus, the genes are in the protoplasm.
Yes,
in the
they're
cell,
just not
right?
separated from not the separated, from yeah. the cytoplasm.
So everybody should keep in mind that the genes are in every cell of our body, and they control what goes on in the cell.
Correct.
Okay, so what happens when something goes wrong with the genes? Because you know we hear about genetic diseases and disorders having to do with genetics. So.
Well, we call that a mutation.
Okay, that's the word, mutation.
Mutate in Greek means to change, and that's what a mutation is. Something happens to cause a change in this DNA code, these letters. The change can be an addition of letters, a deletion of letters, or just a substitution. An A can become a G or something else. We all know about a terrible disease called sickle cell anemia. It's a horrible disease, and it shortens people's lives. And sickle cell anemia is in fact one change in one of these DNA letters out of the 1,800 that are responsible for making the hemoglobin chain in our blood. So that change in just one letter causes this devastating disease.
Mm-hmm. So how many genes do we have? As humans,
that was a big surprise to us when during the genome project we thought we had something like 30,000, 40,000, or 50,000 genes. We really have, it turns out, 23,000 genes that are coding for proteins.
Okay, so
by the way, a chicken has the same amount. Corn has 32,000.
Okay, so. We think ourselves as king of the heap, and that the epitome of evolution. But we haven't spoken about the tree of life that Darwin has in his book, and that we're just one branch on that tree. You want to mention something about that, Saul, and then we'll get back to what causes the mutations and what happens.
Well, I think we have trouble with Darwin and his theory because it dethrones us.
Right.
It takes us out of the center. We're very egotistical and we want to be in the center. And I can talk about that later, but that's what science has been doing to us for the last 500 years. It's taking us out of the center of the universe. The Earth is not the center and we are not the center. And as you said, we are merely a little leaf on a tree that is the tree of life. When Darwin wrote his book, he had one illustration in The Origin of Species, and that was the tree of life.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back for a second. We have a few minutes
to mutations.
Left. Mutations. Yeah. What causes mutations? You know,
anything that damages DNA.
Yeah, so can you give us an example of what?
Well, cosmic rays are coming from outer space. If they can hit the DNA, they can change it. Ultraviolet light coming from the sun. Chemicals. But another way that DNA changes or mutates is in the normal process. When the DNA molecule is copying itself, it's not 100% perfect, and it makes mistakes. And it's these mistakes that natural selection has been operating on for the last 3.5 or 4 billion years that life has existed on the planet. If you think about it, without these mistakes, nothing would change.
Right. So when we think of mutation, it has a negative connotation because we know about diseases caused by defects in the genes. But as you said, there are mutations going on all the time, and therefore parents and children don't look exactly the same either. There's a little difference in them. And that's the way we have evolution. That's one of the things that drives evolution, is these mutations.
The other thing is, of course, is sex.
Right.
Sex is the spice of life in more ways than one. And the fact that we have sex means that we mix up the genes. We make new combinations of genes. But we do. We also get mutations. On average, we get in our bodies about 100 mutations through our lifetime. And if these mutations occur in the sex cells, in the eggs or the sperm, then they get passed on. They get inherited, and they're subject to natural selection.
Okay. So it's important to remember that the mutations are a very important part of evolution.
Mutations are neither good nor bad.
No,
it's what the environment does to them.
Right. So that's one thing. And the reason why, well, people always ask, why do we have sex to reproduce? Because there are critters who don't have sex to reproduce. But the advantage of sexual reproduction is a mixture of genes from the male and the female of the species. So if you mix these genes together, you get change. So that's why you look a little like your mother and you look a little like your father, but you don't look exactly like them, because then you would be a clone. You've heard about cloning. Clonings are creatures that have the exact same genes as their parents.
You know, blue eyes is a mutation that occurred in humans about 6,000 years ago. So think about this. You could have a man who's tall, and you could have a man who has blue eyes. But if you get a tall man with blue eyes, what woman could resist him?
That's right. Well, you're tall, so let me have blue
but
eyes.
But I don't have blue eyes. I don't have blue eyes.
No,
sorry.
But you're good enough looking without that, so it's all right.
Well, you're my friend. That's why you say that.
Of course. Okay, so this topic of Darwin and genetics and all that is really fascinating. And I understand that not too many people actually read The Origin of Species. It's the language is a little antiquated, because it was written in, what year was it written, Tal?
It was published in 1859.
And writing styles were different in those days. But you still can, like the Times last week had an article on Darwin. And they had excerpts of his book, Origin of the Species, and people talking about it. So there's a lot of information that you can get without actually reading it. And you can read it. It's available, and it's in English, but it's in English, as I call it, because he was English, and he wrote in England. So we've covered mutation, which are changes that are naturally occurring, sometimes induced by chemicals, sometimes environmentally caused. And what are the mutations changing? They're changing the genes. The genes are the code that make us what we are. And we've learned a lot more. Darwin never knew about any of this stuff, but he knew that there was something that caused the changes, but he didn't know the mechanism.
That's correct.
Is that right, Saul?
That's right.
Okay. So what we're going to do now is talk a little bit more about Darwin's theory, and we're going to go, you know, Darwin and the Galapagos to sort of go together. But I think what we're going to do with that topic of the Galapagos is we're going to save it another show. We're going to do another show right after this one, a live show, and then we'll talk about Darwin and the Galapagos, because you always hear about that. But just a little aside about Darwin. Darwin's family was very religious. His wife was very religious, and he was very nervous about publishing his works, because he was really, like as Saul said, an iconoclast, And his wife was, as I said, very religious. So he held off on publishing his papers. But his friends said to him, what happened is he got this letter from Wallace. So Russell Wallace, who was doing the same kind of research as Darwin was, and who came to the same conclusion independently about the origin of species, Wallace wrote to Darwin saying, this is my research, this is what I've discovered, what do you think about it? And Darwin was amazed that here was this Russell Wallace who was doing the same thing.
And he panicked.
And he got very nervous because he had put 20, 30 years of work into it. So he proceeded to deliver his paper to the Royal Scientific Society. Is that what
Linnaean,
it was called?
The Linnaean Society.
Yeah, the Linnaean Society is still around today.
In 1858.
Yes. Named after Linnaeus who did all the classification of
Carolus Linnaeus.
Yeah, of animals. So if you come to the Museum of Natural History, and in our big hall where there's a big canoe hanging, you can see Wallace's case. You know, it's a piece of furniture where he kept all of his specimens. And that was just lent to the museum a couple of weeks ago because this is the celebration of Darwin. And Wallace was a terrific scientist also, except he wasn't in the same class as Darwin. Darwin was really upper class, and he knew very important people. And some of his relatives were even famous. Huxley, was he related to Huxley?
No,
or they just
he wasn't
friends?
Related. But Darwin was married to a Wedgwood.
Right. But Darwin's wife was a daughter of one of the Wedgwoods. So you can see he was in society. So he was very comfortable. He didn't really have to work for a living. And he had friends who were very influential. And a lot of his friends, of course, believed in what he was writing. They were very enlightened science people. And they pushed him. They said, you have to get this published because if you don't, then Wallace is going to do it. And in fact, I think they read Wallace's paper also.
What happened was Darwin panicked when he saw Wallace's letter. He spoke to some of these other scientists and said, what should I do? And they said, well, we're going to convene a special meeting of the Linnaean Society. We're going to read Wallace's paper, and we're also going to read Darwin's paper. And that's what they did. And you know what? Nobody paid a lot of attention in 1858.
Yes, it's amazing that there's such a fuss made today about this stuff. And we think that we're so progressive and enlightened. But as Saul gave you the statistics about people who believe evolution and people who don't, it's really amazing. So what we're going to do is we're going to sign off in a minute. But before we do, I want to remind you that my daughter, Erica, has a terrific show on the Heritage Radio Network, and it's called Why We Cook. And she deals with topics all about the foods, and she always deals with seasonal stuff. So I'm sure now she's talking about winter vegetables and things like that. So you can tune into her program too, and she's going to appear one of these days on one of the network shows called Chopped, which is one of these competition cooking shows. And she's been invited to participate in that. So I want to remind you about our sponsor today is TechServe, which is on 23rd Street. It's a terrific place. I've used their services, and they repair and work on Apple products. And very good. And they're a great place to bring your devices to be fixed. Or just to ask questions. It's a unique place if you go in there also. The way it's decorated, you'll see it. There is a shark on one area hanging above it and all that stuff. And by the way, the music that we're playing today was requested by Saul. It's, I don't know if how many of you have guessed what it is, but it's Stravinsky's Rites of Spring. And these Rites of Spring have a lot to do with primitive so-called peoples celebrating spring, which was the time for joy and reproduction and all kinds of erotic activities. And if you want to hear the whole piece of music, you can probably get it online or just get a recording of it. And Saul, which recording do you have of it? You have the original famous one, right?
Oh, not the original famous, but it's an old LP that I have. Yeah. And What I like about it, and the reason I chose it, is that when this piece was first played, it was so unusual that people in Paris rioted. Uh-huh. And that was the same kind of response that happened when Darwin put out his book in 1859. People argued over whether he was wrong or right. It's just so radical. It's so different from what people had been thinking up to then.
Right. So we're going to sign off this program, Heritage Radio Network. I'm Bernie Wides, a naturalist, and my guest today has been Saul Steinbeck, who is a profession. He was a microbiologist, got his PhD in that from City College, Saul. City and Hunter, and he worked for years in the food business. Well, maybe someday he'll tell us about his adventures. So we're signing off now, and we'll be back again with another live show.